Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com. If not us, then who? If not me and you, right now. Well, it's time for us to do something. Yeah.
Welcome to an engaging faith. I'm your host, Elizabeth Reardon, here on Redbox Media. Now, today in Massachusetts, it is balmy. I say balmy. I would say it's perhaps maybe 54 degrees, but at this time of year with the sun streaming, I just am loving the fact that it feels like spring is around the corner. And we had a record-breaking day, right, Margaret?
Yes.
The other day, I think it reached 70.
Yeah, I think it might even have been 80 in Hartford where my parents live, which is about 100 miles from Boston, but I'm ready for it. And then, you know, we changed the clock, so that'll mess up our sleep and everything, but to have some nice daylight in the evenings will be gorgeous.
Well, let me pause for a second to say today's show is with the lovely Margaret Felice, and she joins us here now and every other Friday here on An Engaging Faith. And Margaret, I think that it's funny because I think my body's already adjusting to the time.
Oh, really?
I've been waking up at 4:30 in the morning when I normally get up at 5:30. So something's up.
You're ahead of the game. Good for you. I have not been waking up at 4:30 in the morning, but who knows? Hope springs eternal.
Well, I'm not an early morning person either, so I'm like, what the heck? Elizabeth, go back to bed. So if we are talking and just even looking at the news this past week, I mean, there are so many things. There's as the word, my favorite choice of word would be a plethora, right? Of a banquet of Catholic news.
Indeed.
Starting with this really, I would call it newsworthy in terms of the controversy it sparked. This article on prominent Catholics just say no to Trump. And it's was put out by, I think originally by NCR, but it's been picked up by Catholic News Service and a number of Catholic agencies. And it really focuses around Robert George, who is the professor at Princeton, and George Weigel, who is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center with Catholic Studies. So, you know, it focuses on why a candidate like Trump would appeal, but also why we as Catholics kind of need to be cautious about what he is saying and whether or not the issues he addresses can really be and should be fulfilled in the way he's suggesting.
Yeah, I was really interested to read. I read the letter itself, the open letter in the National Review, pretty briefly, and then I looked more carefully at it today, and it sort of took a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, because National Review, what I found really interesting is that National Review is not a Catholic periodical. It's a political, cultural journal that comes at things from a quite conservative viewpoint. And they were making that case because they had these two writers, obviously, who are prominent Catholics, as the headline in America magazine says. And so first, I thought it was very interesting that they published it at all in National Review. And then I noted that it took, like I said, these two approaches. One is that Trump is really not conservative or conservative enough. All of the ideals that the Republican Party has been putting forward, he's not legitimately backing those up. Even if he's saying all the right things, there's no evidence that he's going to follow through. There's no evidence of this in his background. So they say that, which is one thing, but then, and I shouldn't say but then, because this section actually led. They led with he's vulgar and he's inappropriate. They use the words vulgarity, oafishness, and ignorance. Some other words I jotted down were degradation, that he's stoking fears and prejudice. Really came after him, not just from the stance of does he pass a certain moral litmus test on certain issues, but does he pass a general test of morality in terms of how do we behave? How do we comport ourselves? What kinds of people do we want to lift up? So they addressed both of those elements and really focused not just on, oh, we should find another Republican who's more Republican, but this person and the way he is behaving is not appropriate for civil discourse, regardless of his politics.
Right, right. And I think it speaks to when we look at the world, we kind of tend to draw a line, I think, between the Catholics we are inside the church door and the Catholics we are out in the world. And for me, that's where I see hypocrisy. And if we really take our Catholicism out in and we recognize that it really extends into our society, into our political world, then we can't have two sides of ourselves.
Yeah, and I liked that the letter also sort of addressed the reasons why people were attracted to Trump, saying, you know, there are indeed many reasons to be concerned about the future of our country and to be angry at political leaders and other elites. But they urged Catholics and other voters to consider other Republican candidates who are far more likely to address these concerns, who do not exhibit his vulgarity, oafishness, shocking ignorance, and we do not hesitate to use the word demagoguery. So they're saying it's not necessarily that he's wrong about all these things, but this is where we have to draw the line. Even if this anger resonates with you, you have to keep, like you said, the values that you profess inside the church, outside the church as well. And it's really hard to do that if you're supporting Trump.
Exactly. And as I understand it, Margaret, you had a speaker today come to BC High on how to engage in citizenship from a Catholic perspective.
Yeah, we had a number of speakers today because we gave some awards. So we got to hear from some of our alumni who are very distinguished and have done a lot, but we also had a visitor who works for the Eastern Province of the Society of Jesus. So he works for the Jesuits on the East Coast. He's the, Assistant for Social Ministries. Mm. So he does a lot of work with social issues, civics, those sorts of things. And he was coming to BC High for something else this weekend and very generously said, hey, I'm going to be here all day. Does anyone want me to talk to their classes? And of course, a bunch of us all said yes.
Yeah.
To one group about community service and to another group more broadly about ethics and social justice. But he came and talked to a group of our seventh and eighth graders on, we called it Ignatian politics, which was probably an oversimplification. Mm. But we asked him to talk to them about how do you use your faith to inform your politics? And then how do you have these conversations in a way that honors everyone involved, because, you know, we've got 13, 14 year old kids, they're starting to get really energized and engaged in the political process. They don't necessarily have the tools yet to have these conversations. And as we've mentioned, and a lot of people have mentioned, they're not seeing civil conversation about ideas in a lot of our political process, at least what is easy to find on television today. So he talked about a couple things. He talked about the bishop's document that they put out before all the presidential elections, forming consciences for faithful citizenship. Talked a bit about the idea of conscience. You know, no political candidate, no political party ever toes the party line across the board on all of the issues that Catholics are called to fight for and work towards, all of the life issues, all of the justice issues. So we have to form our consciences so that we can make those judgments, because ultimately you have to make a judgment. There's never going to be a perfect candidate. He kept coming back to Pope Francis's speech to Congress, where he talked about how our legislators, our elected officials, are called to work for the common good, and made a really interesting point that it's our duty as engaged citizens to do what we can to nudge our representatives toward working for the common good. If there's a way that we can write a letter or make a phone call or get involved that will support the work that our legislators do on behalf of the common good, rather than the temptation to engage in bluster or focus so much on fundraising that you're not working for the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So he kept coming back to being pursuers of the common good, and then talked a lot about dialogue and conversation and how hard it is, especially with the people closest to us, because, you know, we know they have to accept us. Our friends and family have to accept us. So we say whatever we want. Mm-hmm. And we need to just be really mindful. He didn't gloss over how hard it is, but what I thought was most valuable was that he provided a model of how you can do this, both named it as a priority, but also sort of showed it in the way that he was talking about these issues. So it was really helpful. He gave us a lot of good resources, and the kids seemed ready to hear it, right, and really thoughtful about how they're going to try to be more conscious of the ways that they talk about politics and the ways that they talk with other people.
Well, certainly, Margaret, is a topic that our kids need to hear, because if they don't hear it from us, how are they going to learn how it is that they're supposed to act and be in the world around them?
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more with Margaret Felice this afternoon here on An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon on Breadbox Media.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to An Engaging Faith. We are joined today with the always wonderful and lovely Margaret Felice. And we are going to, I think I'd like to jump really kind of into Lent and just doing a review of kind of the things that are coming up and things that have happened with Lent. I know last weekend was Pope Francis's big push for Catholics to go to reconciliation. And some churches were open extra hours. I know one parish in Hingham, Massachusetts, that also did the 24 hours for the Lord. And it was 24 hours with priests fully staffed to hear confessions. Their numbers were 175 people.
Wonderful.
And that's just one parish. And just imagine how many people, you know, are really that could take advantage, right? Both with the priest being able to take advantage of those that want to come back to reconciliation, but also for people to go to reconciliation. I know within the Boston Archdiocese, we have The Light Is On For You, and literally that light symbolizes that chance to reconnect with our relationship with God and with our community. The things that sometimes are the weight of what we're carrying just is in between and kind of keeps us from fully recognizing the love that God has for each one of us.
Yeah, I've been really impressed. I've seen a lot since they initiated The Light Is On For You. I've noticed that a lot of parishes have just started to offer more Lenten programming in general. And I think, especially in the Boston Archdiocese, which like many dioceses throughout the country, there's a lot of reorganizations going on at different parishes. So parishes are merging, congregations are being asked to join forces, and having all of these activities that might be something that's really conversation-based, like a Bible study, or something that's more formal worship-oriented, like reconciliation, that gets the people in the parish together in a new way, I think is so valuable in our particular context, but of course has an obvious value no matter where you are. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this. I probably have. But I did my master's thesis on the Sacrament of Reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very pro reconciliation, but I also am convinced that it needs to be sort of teed up in a way that is not just, well, okay, Father will be in the confessional from 3:40 to 3:55 and you should all get in line, because it just doesn't work. People don't go when it's like that. We know it gets the same people, mm-hmm. but it's an older model that worked for some people and just doesn't work today. And I don't think we should feel, a lot of people get sort of, oh, kids these days, even though they're talking about people our age and older, but you know, why won't people, we used to this and that. And I try not to get too hung up on that. I think selling people on reconciliation, to use a term that may be a little crass to talk about it in market terms, is just harder today. And I don't mind that we have to work a little harder at opening up the sacrament to other people. I think as ministers, it's our job.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, as those of us who are employed by the church are glad that it's our job, because it puts food on the table. So it's nice that we're able to offer our gifts and sort of put these activities together. We're doing some reconciliation for the students closer to the end of Lent. And we really have tried to set up a culture that makes it low stress. The priests come out and talk to them. They all just, anyone who wants to goes to the chapel. No one's required to go into the confessional. They can just hang out, listen to music, do spiritual reading, work out. We have worksheets for them if they just want to take reflective time on their own. The priests come out, they say hi. We give them a cheat sheet so they know what to do, because a lot of these kids haven't gone since they made their first reconciliation. So why not make people comfortable? Why not make it something that is accessible? And I don't want to say easy, it's never easy, but something that minimizes the stress for people as much as we can. Of course, they have to meet us halfway, but I think more people will meet you halfway than will meet you all the way.
Well, I love it that my son, Peter, because he attends a Catholic school as well, he came home the other day and said, "Mom, I went to reconciliation today." I'm like,
awesome.
Good boy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like you get a gold star. Good job. I'm like, "And how did you feel?" He goes, "Great. I feel so much better." And that, I think, when we're talking about the selling point of going to reconciliation, is watching how people are after they received reconciliation. So if you're on the fence and you're thinking, "Oh gosh, do I really want to take that time and go to reconciliation?" Just go and sit and watch people before they go in and watch people when they come out.
Yeah, I'd never thought of that. The other piece of advice that I often give, and everybody's different, but a lot of people, they want to wait until they can go somewhere where they're totally anonymous. They're like, "Oh, I'm going to go, I'll be in another state, so I'll just go when I'm over there." And I've found that as hard as it is to be honest with someone you know and about something so personal, having someone who knows your story, or at least your context, they may not have to know you very well, but someone who knows that, you know, you have a couple of kids, they might know that because they see you drop them off for CCD, or even just that knows that you're in the parish. They know sort of your context in that way. And to develop a relationship with someone, I found really valuable. I'm sure you know, and a lot of your listeners probably know, that the practice of private confession really only came about in the monasteries the Celtic monasteries in like the 600s, 700s, 800s, because people, well, there were a couple reasons, but the one I want to touch on is that confessors were also becoming spiritual directors.
Well, so exactly.
For spiritual direction, and they'd fold it all in. Prior to that, penance was public, which also has a great value in that it reminds you that sin and reconciliation are communal. They're things that have to do with the community. But of course, people would never do it because it was public. And they said, well, why don't we just make it individual? But then, you know, sometime in the Middle Ages, we lost that sense of the spiritual direction piece, and it just became private, but also very clinical, like mm-hmm. check things off the list. So if you can find someone that can do both of those things, it's really a great gift, but also maybe a privilege for those of us who spend a lot of time around priests. I'm thinking about
right. Well,
our average listener who may not have 6 or 7 priests that they see every day that they can choose from.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are joined today with Margaret Felice. And on that point, Margaret, about spiritual direction and confession, my spiritual director is also my confessor. And so when we're leading into spiritual direction, it's been really helpful for me because he knows where I'm coming from. He's right there. He knows what I'm working on. He knows the things that I, the pitfalls that we can all fall into. And I think it's very, very helpful for me to have him in both, to know me that well. But for those that might feel a little less comfortable, just know that when you're going into reconciliation, they are not permitted to share it with anyone. And it does not even influence how they look at you, because think of how many confessions that they hear.
Yeah. they get real good at not listening.
Yeah, they get really like good at forgetting, at not retaining.
Yeah.
And because they're not supposed to retain the sin, right?
Mm.
It's absolved. But when we look at Lent really quickly, Margaret, I came across this little go-to sheet on 10 things to do when your Lenten plan fails. And it's by Catholic Link, and I thought it was really cute because the first thing to do is accept it. You know, I had a thumbs up. Accept and know that your plan has failed. Number 2, go to confession. Number 3, get back up. Number 4, ask yourself what went wrong. Now, that's a really great Ignatian step, is that reflection. And then pray. And prayer helps us to all. We know not only to recognize where we went wrong, but to also gain the strength to go forward. And they said to fast, to give alms, to listen. I love that one. Follow the advice from other people in your life. Focus on accomplishing what you set out to do. But also the last step is ask for help.
Mm.
So how often do we walk around acting like we know what we're supposed to do and we really have no clue?
Yeah, it was really great for myself and my husband this year. Our first Lent as a married couple, to talk together about how we wanted to observe Lent, and that element of having someone to help you. I mean, I'd spent a lot of time when I was younger, my mom and I would talk over ideas, but it had been a long time since I had someone who I could talk things out with and really come up with sort of a life-giving way of observing Lent that we could both do, even if we weren't doing the exact same thing, still share the experience and do together.
Well, we are going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more with Margaret Felice this afternoon here on An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Brereton on Redbox Media.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
If not us, then who?
Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon here on Breadbox Media. And we are joined today by Margaret Felice. She is a religion teacher at BC High. She is an opera singer. She is a blogger at margaretfelice.com. And we're kind of running down some of the topics that have hit the Catholic news airwaves this last week. And I would be remiss if I didn't stop and talk about, well, there was International Women's Day on the 8th, so just a few days ago, but it also set off the National Catholic Sisters Week, which goes on from March 8th through the 14th, so it began on Tuesday. So many reasons to thank our sisters. They're following a very beautiful vocation as a woman in the footsteps of Mary and in the footsteps of Christ. And it also brings to the forefront, I would say, Margaret, the recent event in Yemen where the nuns were killed, the missionaries of charity.
Yeah, it's a tragedy that it's happened, but I've been glad to see that the response has been one of such awareness and compassion and grief. I know it sounds weird to say you're glad for grief, but we've seen throughout history that sometimes it's things like this that need to draw people's attention to issues. I mean, the same thing happened with the four church women in El Salvador, God help us, 36 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're still dealing with the same things. I was quite shaken because two of those sisters were from Rwanda, and I lived for a few years with a few Rwandan sisters when they were studying in the United States. So of course I panicked that it could have been one of them. And yes, that would have been tragic, but what happened was no less tragic. Sisters Anselm, Marguerite, Reginette, and Judith, two from Rwanda, one from Kenya, and was one native to Yemen? Now I forget where the fourth was.
I'm not sure where the fourth was from.
But to see the way that people have lifted them up, and of course that they were missionaries of charity, the order that Mother Teresa was a part of, also, you know, people sort of hook into that. They notice that they're of the same order, they wear the same garb, and I think it gets their attention as well. And it also gives people this idea, because we associate that so much with such good work, it reminds people immediately, viscerally, that these women were doing such good work. They were working in a nursing home in Yemen, which I'm ashamed to admit, until I was researching for today, I did not know was in the middle of a civil war. I did not know was the poorest country in the Middle East. I was not aware of any of these things that people are saying that the martyrdom of these sisters may call awareness to, and these people came into the nursing home and killed most of the staff working at a nursing home. It's just heartbreaking.
But even if given the chance to leave, I know we had a speaker come to Resurrection Parish in Hingham, and he was speaking on divine mercy. And he belonged to an order that travels to Africa. And even though his country had been really in civil unrest, people were being killed left and right and dragged in the streets. And it took a lot of persuasion, basically that call to obedience for him to leave.
Yeah.
Because he felt like, this is when my people need me the most, he said.
Yeah, and there's this. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, and that's a beautiful witness to what it is to follow the religious life vocation. And though we ourselves may not, you know, that may not be our calling, to understand the very grave risks that they're putting their lives in to follow Christ.
Yes, when I talk about these events in history with my students, or even when I think about them now, I think it really speaks to the power of prayer and discernment in their lives. I think members of religious orders discern in conjunction with their superiors. So sometimes what an individual thinks they have discerned might not be what their superior suggests, but they go through such a process to find the right place. You know, it's such a process of prayer just to take religious vows, to join an order, to go somewhere, to figure out the right work that you're meant to be doing. And then you realize just that, that it's what you're meant to be doing. And I think it promotes this unshakability, which sometimes can seem like stubbornness, but really I would imagine comes from a conviction that they have, that they are exactly where they are meant to be, because they have prayed and they have discerned and they have talked to other people about what their role should be, where they should be at that moment. So when I hear these stories, and of course I can't, again, I can't shake the parallels between the four church women, and I've talked about them a lot with students. So some of this is projecting onto these nuns, these sisters in Yemen, things that I've thought about the four church women in El Salvador. But the idea that their fear is not stronger than their conviction that they're exactly where they need to be, it really tells me a lot about their inner lives and their inner strength and their ability to discern and make prayerful decisions.
Well, right. We are joined today, if you're just tuning in, we are joined today with Margaret Felice. And Margaret, another article that came across on this topic was, well, on the topic of women and International Women's Day, it was Seeing Migrant Women Through the Eyes of Christ, and it was written by Nicole Flores, and it was entitled The Invisible Woman, and it was just beautifully written. And I was really taken by, because I know, I was taken by the story because it touched upon a friend of mine that I met at BC that was that will be in May receiving her master's in theology. And her experience as a woman living on a border town in Mexico.
Wow.
And she was witness to women being carted off in the middle of the night, never to be seen again, taken as they're walking on their way to work, raped, like brutally raped, and left in the middle of the streets. As a sign for what the gangs have, the power that they have.
And yeah, I really recommend this, The Invisible Women by Nicole Flores. It's from a few years ago in America Magazine, and I didn't catch it the first time around, but it's so beautifully written, but also so simply written, very clear, sometimes devastating in its clarity.
I agree. And when we think about the products that we have, right, Margaret?
Mm.
When we look to get the cheapest made product or an abundance of, as they noted, lettuce and almonds and eggs and apples, I mean, where are we getting those from? And who is the face and the life behind that product that we're receiving?
And yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I think we can't ignore that.
I agree. I think the levels of complicity are so apparent in this article. It called to mind a couple things. I'll see if I can squeeze them all in without going on and on. She mentions that, you know, our market demands cheap migrant labor, but also criminalizes workers. So there's that. There's also that women don't want to speak out because people assume that they're liars. And it just amazes me. I think with most reports of sexual assault, people assume that women are liars. And maybe there's a case to be made for putting the burden of proof on the accusers. But we already know, especially for women who are already so vulnerable, that speaking up comes at a cost. What would it gain them? That we don't believe women when they say these things is just horrifying.
Right.
To me. But I also noticed that, you know, last night on the Republican debate, they've been talking about this certain visa type that brings people into the country. They can only work for one employer, and the employers can then be abusive towards them. And Donald Trump is saying, actually making a very good point, that it allows people to exploit workers, which isn't right. But then he says, I use them because I'm a businessman and that's what I do. And that's where my heart just sinks, is noticing that there are all of these companies and industries that are a part of this and could fix it and choose not to because it's not a priority for them. These people are victims, and so many people could work to ease their suffering, and we don't.
Right. Well, we're joined today by Margaret Felice, and we're discussing this article, The Invisible Woman by Nicole M. Flores. And I look forward to kind of picking up on this and talking a little bit about our favorite Catholic personality, one of our favorites, Stephen Colbert, when we come back here on An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon on Breadbox Media.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com. If not us, then
Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon here on Breadbox Media. And we are joined today by Margaret Felice of MargaretFelice.com. And we were discussing this really amazingly written and articulated argument for The Invisible Woman. And yes, it was a couple of years ago, but it's really very relevant. And when we look at our political elections, just to come back to where we started, how can we have attitudes that see things as us and the other? How can we really draw that line when God is calling us to see God in every one of us? That Imago Dei is called the image of God present in every person. And if you think that it can happen to you, it can. You know, if we make a habit of ignoring that God is in every person, that there is something that is valued like human dignity, then one day it might be us. So if you're for totally self-centered reasons, you have to look at this in that way, then look at the person in front of you as one day possibly being you.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. And I think, you know, what we're hearing right now is so extreme from some people that it forces us to have these conversations. There was a long time when I would have told you that all politicians want to make sure that everyone is taken care of. And what we disagree about is, how do we do that? What's the best way to do it? There were some pretty clear divisions between political parties of how do we do that. That was one area where you could really distinguish between the different political parties. And I was thinking about it this week, or maybe last week. I've been meaning to write a blog post about it at MargaretFelice.com, but I haven't gotten to it yet. That my new sort of litmus test for someone, a politician, is how do they talk about the poor and the vulnerable?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess now that I think, like, if we think way back to things that people said about welfare queens and super predators, people have been using this degrading language for a long time, and they've been using it across party lines. I'm not calling out one party or another, but I think back to one of the big sort of bombshells in the last presidential election was when they had that hidden camera footage of Mitt Romney talking about the 47% of people who just want freebies. They want everything handed to them. And I thought, what a degrading way to talk about people, a large group of people, some of whom need help, some of whom don't. But the idea that there's a huge portion of the population that is all just lazy and wants stuff, I thought, what an awful way to talk about the citizenry. And, you know, I have respect for Mitt Romney. My hope always was that that was a blip for him, because he does seem like a good man and a man of faith. And I find it hard to believe that he really feels that way when he's at his best, when he's gotten enough sleep. And so, long story short, my new criteria is, how do people talk about the powerless? How do people talk about the vulnerable? Do they talk about them as, you know, these women who are lying about being raped? Do they talk about them as these lazy women who don't want to get a job, who can't stop getting pregnant, in this really pejorative language? Or do they talk about them with a sense of dignity? And you can critique the problems, and you can even critique actions while still maintaining the dignity of people. And that's my new criteria. If you can't talk about all people with respect, as if they have some dignity, then I don't want to hear it.
Well, you know, I found there was an article on Stephen Colbert. Pause for mild applause.
Stephen, if you're listening, I'm your biggest fan.
See, I was waiting for that.
I knew you were.
Because we are joined by Margaret Felice, for if you're just now tuning in. And Margaret happens to be, I do believe, Stephen Colbert's biggest fan, though I'm right there with her. I think that this article that was by the Catholic News Service, it was interesting because when he's talking about politicians and their tendencies to, quote unquote, express their thoughts and prayers after, let's say, the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, or in the midst of Columbine, you know, when we look at politicians doing that, he said, while it's not going to fix the problem, it is a way for us to share together publicly in grief.
Mm.
And I thought that was really interesting for him to bring up that point, because when we think about hypocrisy and when we're looking for real answers, I think there's still some truth even in the very public image that politicians portray. But another interesting thing is that they did this whole kind of percentage of who's really tuning into Stephen Colbert, and because he's bringing Catholicism to the public at large. And I found it interesting that 30% of his viewing audience identified themselves as atheist.
Yeah.
What?
It really makes you wonder, are they putting up with the Catholic stuff, or is it so entertaining that they don't notice? I thought that was interesting. I also thought, who knew that the majority, 41% of Catholic late night viewers watch Jimmy Kimmel?
I don't.
I thought, what do you know? But it really shows that statistics sometimes just don't mean anything at all.
I know. But I do find it interesting, because when we think about this new evangelization, right, a term that's been thrown around a lot, we are being called to reach both the Catholics that have been disenfranchised with how they're looking at our Catholic faith being witnessed, but also to bring into the fold people that have really a hard stance on Catholicism. And I think that Colbert is doing that in a way that is authentic and attractive.
Yeah, and I think what's attractive, or what I hope is attractive, because it's something that I try to model in my life, is showing that faith can be so integrated in a person's quote unquote normal life. There's so many stereotypes about what a faithful person is or does or how they talk or what they do or what they think. And to just be someone, to truly be yourself and have your faith totally integrated in that, I think that's the best evangelization that's out there, to show that it doesn't have to be something you layer on or something that you like zip yourself up in that's all constricting. It should be at your core. It's shining out of you in your own unique way. And with his, a job like his that is so unique, it's really easy to see that.
Exactly. It's very hard to be on TV or even on radio and to not witness authentically, to not let your faith be a reflection of who you really are, because it's not, I'm searching for the way to say this, you can't convey faith and witness without it being connected to who you are, without it reflecting from inside out.
Yeah, people are going to read the fake all over it if you're trying to share someone else's faith rather than your own.
Right, and Colbert is, he says that, you know, even though he is a practicing Catholic, he says, doesn't mean I'm good at it.
That's why we practice.
And that is a lesson for all of us. When we look at Lent, take the time today and see that just there is that element of practice and a way of rediscovering our faith that can help us to see what God really wants for our lives, to see who we could truly be and who we truly are in God's eyes. And to allow that to show to others. And not feel like we have to have a dividing line between who we are inside the doors of the church and who we are outside the doors of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But Margaret, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. My pleasure as always. And I'm not sure that I'll be on with you anytime before Easter. So everybody, keep a good Lent. Stay strong.
All right. And check out her blog at margaretfelice.com. And thank you all for tuning in and listening to An Engaging Faith with Elizabeth Reardon here on Breadbox Media.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.